The new year means new legislative sessions in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. With the Trump administration taking office later this month, what will that mean for our state governments in Columbus, Frankfort, and Indianapolis? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today for our weekly news review, we're going to talk about what to expect with regional politics this year and look back at the big political stories of 2024. Joining me now to do that are Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Welcome back, all of you. I thank you all so much for being here.
Happy New Year.
Glad to be here.
Yes, Happy New Year to all of you. Karen, what would you rate as the most significant legislation that passed in 2024 in Ohio, something that's really going to shape the course of 2025?
Wow. This was a fairly unproductive legislature session, the two-year session. The lame duck period was very productive, about four dozen bills passed. But a lot of them, when you talk about big impact, I'm just not sure that a lot of them really fall into that category. I mean, you've got some bills like the Parents' Bill of Rights, which gives and ensures that parents have more right to find out what's happening in their child's classroom. It also requires school districts to come up with policies that allow for release for religious instruction. So that affects potentially parents who have kids in schools. There were some spending bills that went forward. The big thing is, I think what I'm looking forward to in terms of looking ahead is the budget, because this is Governor Mike DeWine's last budget. And I think that's going to potentially, budgets are huge, policy documents as well as with all the money in there. And I think that's a big thing to watch out for going forward.
Yeah, and we'll certainly talk about that. I wanted to get your thoughts. What about the legislation related to trans youth? Ohio lawmakers passed a number of bills related to trans youth last year, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, in the General Assembly's two-year session, there were several bills that specifically looked at, well, the LGBTQ community would talk about restricting the rights of trans people. For instance, a bill that would ban trans athletes from girls' sports and ban gender transition treatments for minors. There was also a bill that would ban trans folks from using bathrooms that align with their gender identity. They'd have to use bathrooms that correspond with the gender assigned at birth. And that's not only for public and private, but also for K through 12, as well as higher education. So that's a pretty widespread thing. But I think that this, we've seen a lot of these kind of bills go forward because, I mean, the legislature is very Republican. Republicans are in the supermajority in the House and the Senate. And these were big talking points for Republicans in the presidential election. So it stood to reason that we were going to see some of these bills come forward.
Sylvia, when you look back at Kentucky's 2024 legislative session, what was the most consequential legislation that passed in your view? What really stands out to you?
Sure. I mean, there are a few pieces of legislation that I think are quite notable from this session, both ones that passed and those that didn't. Most notable among the successful category of legislation is the Safer Kentucky Act. It was a very heavily discussed piece of legislation and a massive one. I mean, many lawmakers noted that it's a omnibus piece of legislation. It packs a lot of bills that have been unsuccessful maybe in the past, some new things, some old things, into this giant package, anti-crime bill. That included what I'm sure listeners might remember, a controversial ban on street camping that's now in effect. It also institutes a three strikes law on violent felony offenders, creates a carjacking statute. It really did a huge number of things and split Republicans a little bit, although largely in support. And so we're seeing the impacts of that coming out now. We also, you know, for example, had an anti-vaping bill that went into effect a couple days ago that essentially banned a large number of products that were on Kentucky shelves. Also put in place the bill that touted as the Momnibus bill. It expanded some maternal health care access, especially access to insurance, creating new enrollment periods for mothers, for expectant parents. Also, you know, a porn age verification bill, things like that. There's a lot of things that passed this year and that, or I guess, I suppose last year, that could have a really big impact on a lot of Kentuckians.
You mentioned the street camping ban, Sylvia, and you reported on an interaction between a Louisville police officer and a pregnant woman cited for street camping. She said she was in labor. The officer called an ambulance for her. And as she was waiting a little ways in the street for EMTs to arrive, this is what we hear.
Ma'am, come over here right now and stand over here. Right over here. Now.
You don't have to
get out of the street.
You don't have to push me. I'm coming.
Out of the street.
You don't have to push me. I'm coming.
Stay right here. I have EMS humming.
Okay, but you don't have to holler. You don't have to push me. I haven't done anything to you.
Okay.
Sylvia, you mentioned that street camping ban was controversial. We've certainly had a number of conversations about it on our program. What's been the fallout from that law as it took effect in the summer?
Sure. So essentially what this what that element of the Safer Kentucky Act does is it bans anybody from sleeping, intending to sleep, or camping out on public streets and public areas that are not designated for such activities. And essentially how it's being implemented, it is on homeless people who don't have somewhere else to sleep, perhaps, people who maybe have previously declined a shelter access, things like that. So this very specific incident came from a body camera footage from a Louisville Metro Police Department lieutenant. And depicts one of the potential outcomes of this legislation, which is a woman who is in she's in a medical emergency. She's just her water is broken and she says she needs to go to the hospital. And as she's waiting for the ambulance that the police officer did call for her, he also cites her for street camping. We're also seeing other impacts from that street camping ban. Something I've reported on previously is also that a number of people, these citations that officers hand out require someone to go before a judge. In some cases, in many of the cases, really, these are people who don't have access to transportation. They don't have a house. They can't receive mail like a court summons. Many of them don't show up for their court date, and that can lead to and is leading to bench warrants taken out for their arrest. So what is a citation that would only carry a fine is also leading some people to be arrested for police for failing to show up at their court date as well. So we're really seeing a lot of wide-ranging effects, and I will continue to see those. This ban has only been in effect since July, and we're still kind of seeing what's happening, what's coming out of it.
We got an email from Nicholas who writes, how will the street camping ban impact Ohio? Sylvia, I'm not sure that you've reported on that. I could be wrong. We had a state lawmaker in the studio a few weeks ago who spoke about that actually after our program and said he has heard that there are more people street camping in Ohio, in Cincinnati, just across the river from Kentucky, because of this ban. I don't have verification on that, but have you done any reporting on that, Sylvia?
I haven't, and that would be really interesting. I mean, it sounds like it'd be a very difficult thing to investigate, but worthwhile. I mean, that is something that advocates have told me is they fear is a consequence of these bans, right? So somebody feels that they have nowhere else to go, sleeps on the street, and then they're criminalized also for that and is told that they can't sleep on the street. If they feel that there are no other options in Louisville or Kentucky, I mean, where else do you go? You leave the state potentially. So I do think that that's something advocates have mentioned to me in the past, that it drives people out of communities potentially. And I think that that's definitely something worth looking into. I could imagine if you feel that you cannot legally exist in Louisville, in Kentucky, that you would be driven across state boundaries potentially.
Yeah. Brandon, I've heard you say that Indiana's 2024 session was quieter than previous years, certainly than the budget session before. Does anything stand out for you about last year's session, or was it really, truly just very quiet?
It was almost entirely very quiet. There was a lot of hubbub and a lot of controversy and a lot of back and forth between the two chambers over a bill defining and then banning anti-Semitism in higher education. But in terms of impact, that bill arguably has almost no impact because there's not a lot it does. Well, first of all, it wasn't signed into law. It was vetoed by the governor, and then he passed an executive order in part because of the controversy over the definition of anti-Semitism in the law. But even then, it arguably doesn't do anything that existing laws, both federal and state, don't already cover. In terms of actual impact, I think the biggest thing that lawmakers did was a continued focus on literacy rates among Indiana students. Indiana students have very poor literacy rates in terms of passage of the third grade reading exam that Indiana administers to all students. And they put in kind of stricter procedures for how and when students are allowed to advance beyond third grade if they don't pass that exam, but also did a lot on the front end of better tracking, more testing early on before they get to third grade to kind of identify, okay, here's students who are struggling and need extra help. They put a greater emphasis on summer school, although they're going to continue to look at that in 2025 because, as they've discovered, they spend a significant amount of summer school dollars, and a significant amount of the students are in physical education classes in the summer. And so they want to kind of reprioritize that a little bit and focus more on things like literacy and reading and that and math and STEM education. So that was, in terms of impact, I think a greater focus on improving the literacy scores, and then in terms of impact, once that sort of the stricter rules about advancing students beyond third grade, if they don't pass that exam, once those kind of take greater hold, which will be going forward, I think that will be the big impact coming out of 2024.
Talking about regional politics for the full hour today. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Let's talk about some big legislative priorities or bills that didn't pass. Karen, are there measures that really stand out to you in terms of things that lawmakers or the governor were pushing for during the last legislative session that didn't pass?
Well, just building on what I just heard there, the anti-Semitism bill, there was one that was proposed in Ohio that did not move forward, but it generated a lot of debate last month. And we also have an executive order in place banning anti-Semitic activity. But after a neo-Nazi march in Columbus, there was new interest in moving forward this bill, though it passed the Senate, it didn't pass the House. So when you look at some of the bills that didn't pass, I mean, a lot of times it's the bills that we pay a lot of attention to, but then they don't end up moving forward. I mean, there are 1,000 bills that are proposed in a two-year session in Ohio, and most of them, of course, don't get through. And especially in this particular two-year session, we had a split between the House Speaker and the Senate President, so a lot of legislation didn't move forward. That's going to be resolved because the Senate President is becoming the Speaker, so we should see a lot more partnership, I guess, with the House and Senate. But there were Governor Mike DeWine wanted some new rules on Delta 8, which is he calls it intoxicating hemp or diet weed. It's not regulated like marijuana is regulated. He wanted some rules on that. There were some issues on energy and pension, and there was a pay raise that was proposed for lawmakers that didn't get through. Those are just a couple of things that are out there.
Yeah. What about in Kentucky, Sylvia? Were there any big priorities or bills that seemed to be priorities for lawmakers that just didn't get through this past session?
Yeah, there were a couple things. There's the kind of perennial issues that get lost between the House and the Senate, and those could very well come up again. But the big thing that really stands out for me right now is anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion legislation, particularly in post-secondary education, so colleges and universities. That legislation, there was versions proposed in the Senate and the House, and eventually, the one that appeared to be the bill that was going to go through was a more severe version that would have really banned any sort of DEI initiative at colleges and universities, any sort of job position, things like that, required a lot of reporting to the legislature and things like that on any spending. That bill failed at the very end, and we kind of got some hints that it may have been because of disagreement between the leadership of the chambers on how far they wanted to go on DEI regulation and limiting in higher education. And we've heard some indications that that is likely to come up again, that there is a lot of hunger for that in the Republican caucus. So that's one of the bills that I definitely expect to see at least some sort of movements and potential discussions on this session.
What about in Indiana, Brandon? Were there any big issues that seemed to have a lot of momentum this past session that just didn't cross the finish line?
The big one, and this is going to be one of the dominating themes of 2025, is what to do with Indiana's Medicaid program. So a little over a year ago, in the end of 2023, Indiana found out that it built the budget that it's currently operating under, which was passed in April of 2023, that was working on a Medicaid forecast, how much the state would have to spend on its Medicaid program, that was $1 billion off. They needed to spend about $1 billion more on Medicaid than they thought. And that has led to a bunch of changes within the Medicaid program, but done administratively so far. And one of the biggest is that it's really impacting the most vulnerable people, particularly older Hoosiers, but particularly families of medically complex children. So these are kids that need continuous long-term care, and they had been getting that care at home. Their parents would get money to care for their child, and essentially it was, you know, to make up for a parent always had to be home with these kids, so they couldn't have a job. So you were essentially making up for the income that was lost because that parent was simply unable to work in order to care for their child. Well, they made tremendous changes to that program that families said is going to make it almost impossible to care for their children, because they're significantly cutting the amount of dollars that those families can receive, with the idea being that, well, you should actually be hiring a nurse to come in and care for your child. The problem being, there are simply not enough nurses to do that work in Indiana. And that's not an Indiana problem. That's a problem all over the country, is a healthcare workforce shortage. So in the midst of the state basically trying to save itself money by on the backs of the most vulnerable Hoosiers, lawmakers in the House, both Democrats and Republicans, stood up and said, hey, let's slow down on this. We'll take a harder look at it in 2025, but you need to kind of pump the brakes. And the Senate Republicans just refused to go along with it. They just said, we don't care, essentially, that we will deal with it eventually, but we're going to let the administration, the Holcomb administration, take care of that problem for us in the interim. And so, yeah, that was the big thing that didn't happen, I think. And then we'll see what comes out of all of it in 2025 with a new state budget and, importantly, a new governor.
Yeah.
Can I add something really quick here?
Please do.
It's just really interesting to hear how common some of these ideas are among the three states that we're all representing, because I mentioned that the anti-Semitism thing that was happening in Indiana, we've got that. Also, when Sylvia was talking about the anti-DEI measure specifically aimed at higher education, that's another bill that did not pass, but is expected to come back again. So we have a lot of common threads here going on among all three of our legislatures. And it's interesting to know, because these are Republican ideals, and that's what gets talked about among those three, among lawmakers in those three states.
Definitely. Well, we will continue our conversation after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about regional politics for the hour today, the big news from 2024, and what to expect this year. My guests are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, and Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So we just talked about some of the big pieces of legislation that did pass during this previous session, those that didn't pass. I want to ask each of you, just to really button that up, what the big priorities are that you're expecting to see carry into 2025, or do you think there will be whole new priorities? Brandon, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I just talked a little bit about it, which is Medicaid funding in Indiana. So to put that in context, Indiana will write a new two-year state budget in the 2025 session. And historically speaking, K-12 education takes up 50% or more of Indiana's, now it'll be $46, $47 billion state budget. I mean, that was the way it had been for a long, long time. And as one budget architect talked about recently, he said it used to be that you started with, here's the education budget, let's increase that as much as we can, and now everything else gets a look. That is changing, and this is arguably the first time that will be a little different, which is Medicaid is really, it's growing incredibly fast as a percentage of the state budget. In fact, the amount that Indiana is projected to need to spend on Medicaid in the new budget is almost as much as total new money Indiana is expected to receive in that budget. And so it becomes, because Medicaid is an entitlement, it largely becomes, okay, well, I guess here's all the money we have to spend on Medicaid. We don't even really have a choice there. And now we look at everything else. And so for the first time in arguably three budget cycles, you have Indiana facing a much tighter state budget than it has faced. Not a lot of new money, not a lot of new spending. You know, in the past couple of budgets, it's been influxes of federal COVID dollars, and you know, all the stimulus money led to greater spending, which led to more tax revenue and that sort of thing. It was just Indiana, they couldn't spend money fast enough because they kind of had to in order to keep it. Well, this is going to be the exact opposite of that. It's not going to shrink. They are expecting some economic growth over the next 2 years, but it's going to be very limited, and it's going to create a lot of really tough conversations about priorities at the State House.
Karen, you mentioned that the Ohio lawmakers have a budget session coming up too. What do you expect the big priorities to be for them?
Well, we actually have four budgets in Ohio. We have the General Revenue Fund, the big budget, and that'll be introduced sometime in late January. Also, the transportation budget, the workers' comp budget, and the industrial commission budget. All those have to be passed. I think the transportation budget actually has to be passed by March. So lawmakers have a lot of work to do on those things. I mentioned the higher education proposal, which conservatives have said is a way to push back on what they feel is liberal ideology on college campuses. There's the bill that would have done that in the last General Assembly is going to come forward almost certainly because incoming Speaker Matt Huffman is a fan of this. And so we expect to see that one come forward. Delta 8 and changes in marijuana laws most likely could come forward. And also property tax reform. This is a big one because property taxes have really risen very dramatically in Ohio. And there was a panel that was put together to try to review some of the more than a dozen bills that were proposed on property tax reform, most of which didn't get through. And so there is a lot of concern about passing some of the recommendations from that committee that met on those bills and trying to find some relief for homeowners who are paying a lot more in taxes than they did just a couple of years ago.
Silvio, you mentioned the DEI or the anti-DEI legislation that didn't make it across the finish line, this Kentucky's last legislative session. What are Do you expect that to be a priority? What are the priorities you expect to see this session?
Sure, I definitely expect that to be a priority. I was really nodding along when Brandon was talking about Medicaid. I think that there's going to be a renewed focus on Medicaid oversight, if not this year, then in the coming years. The thing that lawmakers have been very clear on is the first thing they want to do when they get back, at least GOP lawmakers, is institute another tax cut to Kentucky's income tax. Kind of the stated goal right now is to get to zero. They have a few triggers in place that must be met in order for that to happen, and we met them for this year. But I think that there's kind of this consensus that there's going to need to be some shift in the budget at some point if they really truly want to get down to zero. And similar to Indiana, a huge part of Kentucky's budget, I think, as many states' budget is tied up in entitlements, tied up in Medicaid. And so they're going to need to make some changes likely to that if they really want to get down to zero and maintain all the other government programs that are in existence. The budget here in Kentucky is already sewn up, so we're not going to hear more about that likely, or if we do, it's going to be tweaks and changes. One thing that I completely forgot to mention earlier, which is obviously a major thing in Kentucky, is that this year, we now have medical cannabis that became legal January 1st. It's unlikely that that'll really that program's really going to kick in until maybe mid-year because weed in Kentucky has to be grown in Kentucky. And we just did a whole lottery process for that, you know, kind of late into last year. So those places are still getting set up, but that's going to be happening over the course of the year. And I'm sure the legislature is keeping a really close eye on that as well. Lots of different things I just touched on there, but there's a lot of things that we're looking forward to in the coming year.
Yeah. Brandon,
I wanted to jump in too, because it's very similar to the theme that Karen mentioned earlier, which is remarking on the incredible similarities between these three states. Well, Indiana, like Ohio, had huge spikes in its property taxes over the last few years, especially coming out of the pandemic as assessments just grew and grew and grew. And so Indiana set up a two-year commission to study the entire tax code. And when that was formed, which is in 2023, it was very like, oh, maybe we'll eliminate the income tax and, oh, we're going to change all these other taxes. Well, that turned into a, let's just look at property taxes. And ultimately, the recommendations are incredibly broad, very nonspecific, except for businesses. It looks like they really want to cut businesses' property taxes. But the message that they're now sending out, as that report from that two-year commission came out in December or late November, the messaging from that was, we're probably not going to do anything transformational on property taxes, despite the fact that Hoosiers have been saying pretty exclusively that that's what they want lawmakers to focus on. And incoming Governor Mike Braun has made a huge property tax reform effort a centerpiece of his campaign, a centerpiece of his agenda for 2025. And yet the message from lawmakers is, I don't think we're going to change that much, in part because any significant change you make to property taxes would reduce funding for local governments, because in Indiana, property taxes exclusively fund local governments. There's no state funding involved there. And lawmakers can't backfill any local government budget losses because they're not going to have barely enough money for their state budget. So yeah, just again, remarking on the similarities between these states, that's another thing that Indiana and Ohio seem to be dealing with.
And Brandon, it sounds like the lawmakers are just saying, hey, if we do something transformational with property taxes for property owners, for you know, everyday people, that'll just kind of, there are too many dominoes that will fall and cause other problems. Is that the bottom line?
It's absolutely the bottom line. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a really important point, that once you start changing property tax laws, you change how schools are funded, you change local funding. That's a big part of the problem in trying to make some of those changes and give some property tax relief.
Yeah. In Ohio, for sure. Brandon, you had mentioned before the break also that Indiana elected a new governor in November. The race wasn't nearly as close as some people had predicted. How do you think Mike Braun won so decisively, and why couldn't the Democratic Party or the Libertarian Party really break through in a more meaningful way?
It's twofold. One, Indiana is simply a solidly Republican state at this point, a solidly conservative state. That much is increasingly clear. The other thing, though, has arguably nothing to do with Mike Braun or the Democratic candidate, Jennifer McCormick, or the Libertarian, Donald Rainwater, which is that Donald Trump won Indiana by nearly 20 percentage points, which was roughly the margin he won by in 2016. When someone at the top of the ticket, at the very top of the ticket, wins by that large a margin, the cascading effect that has down the ballot means the Democrats simply don't have a chance at any, certainly statewide races or high profile races. There's too many voters who are kind of locked in to that political party because of that top of the ticket candidate, and everything falls from that. I'll also note, though, that Indiana is one of only seven states that allows straight ticket voting with the push of a single button. So when you vote in Indiana in a general election, one of the first things you see on the ballot is, would you like to vote for all the Democrats or all the Republicans or all the Libertarians on the ballot? Press this button here, and you don't look at a single race after that if you select that option. You don't look at a single candidate's name. And that policy has a lot of critics, understandably, because at a time when it seems like we are encouraging low information voting, that is about as low information as it gets, which is choose a symbol. And so I think that is cited as one of the reasons that Democrats often have trouble breaking through in races where arguably they should have a better shot, is because how many voters are just not even paying attention to the races, the candidates, the issues, anything, and just going, boom, political party.
Sylvia, I think Kentucky has that too. Doesn't Kentucky have that straight party ticket voting ability?
Yeah, I think we do. We do have it. Now, obviously, we have had some Democratic breakthroughs here with Governor Beshear obviously winning the top of the ticket. But it's worth noting we have off-year gubernatorial elections here in Kentucky, which some people have attributed to Beshear's ability to break through, right? So, you know, we don't vote for governor in the same year that we vote for our president versus legislative races coincide with national races. So I think that that is an interesting kind of dynamic to look out for. What allows people or what leads people to break out of straight ticket voting? And it might be some of these abilities to differentiate between the candidate and a national race.
Karen, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine's had an interesting relationship with Republicans in the state house this past session. He vetoed some of the bills they passed, only to see his vetoes overridden. What are you expecting from that relationship between the governor and state house Republican leadership in 2025?
Well, he is in his final 2 years of his term as governor. And so when he spoke to reporters before Christmas at a breakfast he had for us, we were asking him about the budget and some of the things that he might want to put in there. Republican lawmakers, like in some of these other states, have wanted to eliminate the income tax and do income tax cuts every time. And so I don't know whether that's something that he wants to do, but he's always been very focused on kids and families and mental health. And so I'll be interested to see if he puts more money toward that. I think that that's something that a lot of lawmakers want to get behind, but the lure of tax cuts really keeps a lot of Republican lawmakers intrigued there. So I think there are some issues on which DeWine differs with supermajority Republicans, but there's a lot that he really supports. And we've seen that through some of his actions. I mean, he most recently he actually signed that bathroom bill that I mentioned earlier, the one that bans trans people from using the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity and not the gender assigned on their birth certificate. So I think that that's something to watch out for. I was just looking at C-SPAN, and Governor DeWine, along with former Senator Rob Portman, were on the floor with Senator J.D. Vance and newly sworn in Senator Bernie Moreno. So there's a lot of Republican closeness there that shows, at least in that. And of course, we're still waiting for DeWine to appoint somebody to replace Vance once he resigns to become vice president.
Yeah. Well, we are going to continue our conversation about regional politics after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This conversation was recorded before House Speaker Mike Johnson was reelected to his position. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about regional politics. My guests are Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Karen Kassler, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. I do want to talk some about kind of the national issues that these three state governments are going to be facing. But Sylvia, I want to circle back to the gubernatorial relationship with the state house in Kentucky. I think it's fair to say there's no love lost between Republican leadership in the state house and Kentucky's Democratic governor, Andy Beshear. You mentioned that he's managed to break through. He won re-election in his off-year election and is, a Democratic governor in a very red state. How are you expecting that relationship to play out during this year's legislative session?
Okay. You're definitely hit the nail on the head. No love lost, I think, is an accurate description of their relationship. A Republican leadership has often kind of bemoaned a lack of relationship between the governor's mansion and the state legislature. It's hard to tell if that's purely based on political lines, if it has something to do with personalities. It's hard to say. I'm guessing political delineations have the larger impact on the relationship. We've seen many attempts and successful attempts, I should say, to limit the governor's power in different ways. You know, for example, last session, they've now made it so you need a special election if a sitting U.S. senator were to leave the office for any reason midterm. It would not be appointed by the governor anymore. You know, changes like that to continue to break down on the governor's power when, you know, in this divided government situation. So I would say it's definitely accurate to say there's a very strange relationship between the two. I mean, they do have moments of agreement, that's for sure. And, you know, it's always so interesting. We talk a lot about the legislation that's the most divisive, but there is plenty that they work on together. For example, medical cannabis that's going into effect this year. That was definitely a bipartisan effort. And so, you know, we'll continue to see, I imagine, a few pieces of legislation like that, especially now that Beshear is term limited. He cannot run for another term as governor. But, you know, at the same time, they're always going to be diametrically opposed on a lot of these issues.
Well, Governor Beshear has been getting a lot more national attention ever since his name was floated as a possible vice presidential candidate. I mean, some people even have talked about him as a possible presidential candidate at some point. What are you watching for there?
Yeah, we're continuing to keep an eye on Beshear, you know, kind of what his activities are. He's done a lot of things to raise his national profile, you know, since his name was floated, but even a little bit before that. You know, he's getting involved in races outside of the state. He, you know, has various political action committees, and, you know, also he has, you know, dark money groups, things like that, that he's influencing other elections in interesting ways, and or at least trying to. And, you know, he's going to speak at events and at other Democratic Party events outside the state. He campaigned pretty hard in the presidential election. You know, he's writing op-eds in the New York Times. He's definitely working on raising his national profile. And so we're just going to continue to watch that and see if does that ramp up, I suppose, to 2028. I mean, worth looking out for sure.
Okay, I've got another Kentucky-focused question for you, Sylvia, and then we're going to get back to Ohio and Indiana. On the national stage, House Speaker Mike Johnson is scrambling to keep his position, to keep his gavel. U.S. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, U.S. Representative Thomas Massie from Kentucky have both come out against his candidacy. Why won't they back him?
Well, you know, both of those characters that you just, Massie and Paul, are both kind of anti-institutionalist in a lot of ways. They both, you know, tend to focus on very specific issues and are not afraid in many cases to speak against the establishment, to speak against what's kind of the party line. You know, one of the things that Paul has noted when in, you know, taking issue with the current speaker is his Ukraine support, which is a big topic for Senator Paul. You know, Massie has, I think one of his tweets, he compared the speaker to Joe Biden and how Democrats kept Joe Biden around in the primary past when they should have, and things like that, which I think was an interesting comment. But it's definitely not surprising. I think I also saw, this is all happening over X, formerly known as Twitter, but Paul also made some comment about, you know, nothing would, quote, disrupt the swamp more than choosing Elon Musk as a speaker. So really, you know, kind of throwing a bit of a wild card out there, right? So I don't think it's necessarily surprising that those two would air grievances, but it does continue to kind of show some of the splintering in the party, frustration with leadership, even, you know, with someone like Johnson, who was, you know, was a surprise pick also, you know. So I think we're seeing that play out continuously, and we'll continue to watch it.
Yeah. Karen, Brandon, or what are you hearing from elected leaders in Ohio and Indiana? Are any talking about breaking away from support for Speaker Johnson? Or are they backing him, or have they said much so far?
Well, I think there were some who had talked about Jim Jordan, Ohio's Jim Jordan, as a possible alternative to Johnson. But I don't think there's been any public displays by any of Ohio's 10 congressmen, Republican congressmen, to break away from Johnson in particular.
Yeah. What about in Indiana, Brandon?
I think you'll see the majority of Indiana's Republican congressional delegation, which is 7 members out of the 9 in Indiana, 9 House members in Indiana. I don't think you'll see many of them break away unless, you know, huge swaths of the chamber start breaking away. But Representative Victoria Spartz is, I think, to put it mildly, a wild card. No one knows what Victoria Spartz is going to do minute to minute. Least of all, I think Victoria Spartz. She you saw this play out in the previous speakership fight 2 years ago. You saw it play out. I think you'll see it play out here, where it's just really hard to know what Victoria Spartz is going to do, again, even minute to minute.
Wow, well, that keeps things interesting. Well, you know, President-elect Donald Trump is going to be taking office later this month, too. Karen, what are you watching politically about what kind of impact his second term could have on Ohio? Is there anything in particular you think could change or have a big impact with a second Trump term?
Well, he will definitely have an impact on who was selected to replace J.D. Vance. We've confirmed that Governor Mike DeWine and Lieutenant Governor John Husted went down to Mar-a-Lago in Florida to meet with Trump and to presumably to discuss the Vance appointment. It appears that the Lieutenant Governor is in the lead for that role, whether he wants to accept it or not and wants to go to DC, that's the real question. There are a lot of Republicans who would like to do it if he doesn't, but then it becomes an issue of who will DeWine pick and who really will Trump and Vance want him to pick. You've got former Ohio Republican Party Chair Jane Timken, who's a possibility. State Treasurer Robert Sprague has said that he's interested. People who have said they're not interested are Vivek Ramaswamy, who's obviously working with Elon Musk on the Department of Government Efficiency. And then Attorney General Dave Yost, who's focused on running for governor, which Husted was also focused on running for governor, but now this could potentially be an opportunity for him. So I think that that's the big impact there is what the person who is selected to replace Vance in the U.S. Senate is certainly going to be a Trump devotee and somebody that Trump supports and supports Trump in exchange.
Sylvia, do you think a second Trump term is going to have a big impact in Kentucky?
Well, that's definitely to be seen and something we'll be watching out for. I think that there's a lot of a kind of a laser focus to see what Trump wants to do on immigration. I think he has many supporters in the Kentucky legislature who would be kind of looking for an opportunity to support any immigration or honestly deportation efforts that Trump tries to put in place. So that's one of the things I'm looking out for. Obviously, when we talk about healthcare, Medicaid, that's going to could have a pretty big impact, whatever Trump decides to do in that regard. FEMA funding, all of these little things, right? They could have pretty huge impacts on Kentucky and any state that's had natural disasters, has high Medicaid population, and things like that.
What about in Indiana, Brandon?
Yeah, in addition to almost literally everything Sylvie just said, applying to Indiana, I think we got a new revenue forecast last month for Indiana to give us a look at what to expect in the state budget for the next 2 years in terms of revenue for the state. And part of that forecast is a national economic forecast done by a firm that comes in and looks at the nation and then Indiana. And there was an entire slide devoted to like bad news for the election of Donald Trump because of what it might mean for the economy. The biggest perhaps for Indiana being that the unknown of tariffs. Being that if there is some sort of global trade war, the industries that it will hit the hardest are pharmaceuticals and kind of life science, medical stuff, manufacturing in general, and agriculture. And Indiana's three biggest industries are life sciences, pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, and agriculture. So I think that is really tamping down economic expectations in Indiana because right now the things that Donald Trump has either promised or is talking heavily about stand to probably harm Indiana's economy.
Karen, do you think legislative priorities in Ohio could shift with a second Trump term, or do you think the state lawmakers are pretty set on the directions they're heading?
Well, Ohio's been a pretty conservative, pretty red state for a while. I mean, when you look back in the last 30 or 40 years, Republicans have really dominated in statewide elections. So I don't think the course of Ohio's legislature is going to change too much. I think they're going to be following a lot of what happens with Trump and the administration in Washington. And obviously, having J.D. Vance, Ohio's J.D. Vance, there does potentially suggest that Ohio is going right along with whatever the Congress and the Trump administration want to do.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a crazy question right now. Biggest prediction for 2025, what do you think is going to be the big story coming out of, or maybe the big unexpected story coming out of each of your state houses? I'll start with you, Sylvia. Do you have any predictions, wild predictions for the new year?
Ooh, I get to go first. Oh, I don't know if I have any really out of left field predictions. I really am going to be keeping a very close eye on Medicaid. I think that changes to Medicaid, changes to healthcare on a national level could have really huge impacts on the statewide level, you know, especially where we have expanded Medicaid here in Kentucky, that's really proven essential for a lot of people in our state. So that I'm going to be watching with a laser focus that could have some huge impacts on our region.
Okay. And in 15 seconds, Brandon, you're next.
Yeah, I mean, the Indiana state budget, but also the wild card of what will potential deportations do when it comes to state authorities and the state economy.
Okay. And 10 seconds left for you, Karen Kassler.
I think there's going to be a spirited debate over whether the state should be giving money to the Cleveland Browns for a new stadium, because obviously the Cincinnati Bengals will be interested in that too.
Ooh, good way to end. I've been talking with Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman, and Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Thank you all so much for your time today and for all your great reporting. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.